Ali Risk.
I think that the United States is being subject to manipulation basically by Israel. It's allowed itself to be subject to manipulation. I think that Israel at this particular phase is very much controlling or taking advantage of the United States. But I do have to also make a point that the relative, lack of escalation, because what we've seen now, it's clear that the Israelis, as I was saying in a previous answer, do not intend to escalate. I think that's something which is very clear. And I think that one major reason behind the fact that they don't want to escalate further is the fact that the Americans are not on board with a full-scale war on Lebanon. This has been made time and again, this statement. American Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has contacted his Israeli counterpart on numerous occasions throughout this war, saying that the situation on the Lebanese-Israeli front must remain beneath a certain ceiling, meaning it shouldn't be transformed into a full-fledged war. The Americans, they do appear to be playing a dubious role. Yes, on the one hand, they speak about the necessity to reach a ceasefire. They speak about efforts to reach a deal. On the other hand, they provide, there was a recent deal worth $20 billion, I think, if I'm not mistaken, worth of weapons, $20 billion or $20 billion, I'm not sure. This does reflect a kind of Israeli double, a kind of American double standards. But when it comes to Lebanon in particular, as I say, I have to stress again, this is my own personal opinion, I do not believe that the Americans are on board with a full-scale war on Lebanon. If they were on board, I think that you would see Israel behave in an entirely different way, especially after the latest events which took place.
We're going to talk to Mariam Saleh, who joins us from Beirut now, in order to get the latest, from southern Lebanon, I'm sorry, in order to get the latest on what has occurred and transpired, and maybe even what we have witnessed now has settled down. Mariam, at this point, the dust has settled a little bit, if I can say that. Give us a wrap-up of what has occurred and what has transpired ever since the announcement by Hezbollah that it carried out its operation successfully.
Concerning the latest developments here in South Lebanon, we know that there was also new shelling from the Israeli warplanes towards the towns of Mesa Jabal as well as Markaba. We also have reports that are unconfirmed coming out from Israeli media saying that Hezbollah has targeted a boat near the maritime waters, the Lebanese maritime waters. And so if this is something that is confirmed, then this probably is the first time that Hezbollah targets a ship in this round of confrontation. Now, this is most probably either a naval boat, which is, of course, for the Israeli military, and usually when we have especially the demarcation of the maritime borders, we still had even a violation of the Lebanese waters with the Israelis' boats, not with big warships, of course, but we do know that they continue to sail in that area and violate Lebanese waters. This perhaps is also a message from Hezbollah saying that they will also respond to these violations also in the sea, as they did, for example, in 2006. That was one of the main surprises when Hezbollah launched a direct attack towards the Israeli warplane Saad, and that then was also considered one of the major transformations of the war as well. Concerning the issue of the recap, perhaps, if we can say, of today's conflict, definitely there was a new phase in the escalation here in South Lebanon. Hezbollah clearly also said through sources to many media outlets that they have clearly made their point that they have begun a retaliation for the assassination of top military commander for Hezbollah, Fuad Shukr, Said Mohsen. They've also will be retaliating at the same time for the attack on the southern suburbs of Beirut, which is considered a direct strike and a crossing of the boundaries that Hezbollah had put forth previously, that they should not attack Beirut or else there will be a bigger response. That strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut had also led to the killing of five civilians. That, too, was another reason for Hezbollah to retaliate. Now, how Hezbollah will be retaliating. They said that today's operation has ended successfully. Does this mean that the retaliation of the first phase has ended? Will there be another part of the retaliation that will be going towards other places, or will it depend on the Israeli reaction towards that retaliation specifically? Now, concerning what Hezbollah targeted exactly, there are a lot of speculations, but we know from Israeli media, the Israeli dailies, talking about what could be a secret headquarters for the Israeli intelligence. You mentioned earlier perhaps the Mossad also headquarters, which is also potentially supposed to be something of a secret place. It's not a headquarters that is well known. And if Hezbollah did succeed in reaching that area with their suicide drones, that in itself is a very significant and critical breach of the Israeli security. We heard from the Israeli officials saying that this is a state of emergency, this is a very serious and hard day for the Israeli military. And what does that mean exactly? It does not mean that Hezbollah, of course, they have begun with their retaliation, but they're not launching their rockets haphazardly towards the Israeli settlements or all across the Galilee. They made very clear objectives. They targeted 11 military sites. That was a diversion in order to allow the drones to pass from Lebanon towards occupied Palestinian territory and to reach their destined target. The destined target has not been declared by Hezbollah yet.
We have breaking news, Mariam. Israeli media has made a statement saying that one soldier, a regime force, has been killed, several injured in Hezbollah strike on Israeli targets. Again, Israeli media making that statement that one Israeli regime force has been killed and several injured based on a Hezbollah strike on Israeli targets. I'm assuming this is from earlier. Do you have any information on that?
This seems to be, of course, there's really a clear blackout from the Israeli side. This is tightly controlled information, but we are getting leaks of that through the Israeli media. This is probably the result of the attack on the naval boat for the Israelis near the Lebanese maritime waters. This is what we're getting from, of course, reports that have not been verified yet, that there are several casualties on this military boat for the Israelis, which is very close to the southern Lebanese border. And this is, of course, on the coast of southern Lebanon. And they said that one Israeli soldier has been killed as a result of this attack, with the fact that we can see there's definitely a lot of information being tightly monitored by the Israelis. But of course, this could also be another surprise attack from Hezbollah's rockets, which the Israelis did probably. Okay. It took them quite some time to be able to uncover that, or even know about it, since, as we know, Hezbollah launched hundreds of rockets simultaneously, in addition to the drones, which we still do not know the number of right now.
Thank you, Mariam Saleh. We appreciate it. From southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh there. Many thanks. Relentless air and artillery strikes continue to pound the besieged Gaza Strip more than 10 months into the Israeli onslaught on the blockaded territory. One of the latest strikes hit a home in northern Gaza City, killing at least 3 Palestinians. The Israeli military also bombed several other locations in the city, as well as Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza Strip. Dozens of Palestinians, including 6 members of the same family, were killed in the attacks. The regime has also been shelling different areas of the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring Palestinians. The Israeli aggression on Gaza, which began in October of last year, has so far claimed the lives of more than 40,300 Palestinians. Over 93,000 Palestinians have also been injured in the onslaught. Millions of Muslims are mourning Arba'in in the holy Iraqi city of Karbala. The occasion marks 40 days since the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. For at least 2 weeks, pilgrims from different countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, have been arriving in Karbala for the occasion. Among them are 3.5 million Iranian nationals. The Arba'in March is one of the largest annual religious congregations in the world. It sees large groups of mourners travel to Karbala on foot. The Iraqi city hosts the shrine of Imam Hussein, who is the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The Imam and a small group of his companions were martyred nearly 14 centuries ago in the Battle of Karbala, after they rose up against the Umayyad tyrant Yazid. The annual pilgrimage of Arba'in is one of the largest religious congregations in the world. Let's get more from Gisu Michel Ahmadi, who joins us. Well, Gisu, you were in the walks. Tell us what happened and what we are looking at for today when it comes to Arba'in.
Well, Kaveh, just as you mentioned yourself, the Arba'in walk from Najaf to Karbala is actually one of the biggest religious gatherings in the world. Last year, according to Iraqi statistics, more than 25 million people took part in the walk. And this year, we're expecting that number to be even more, which makes it among the top biggest religious gatherings in the world. Now, for many people, this walk, because of the huge crowds that are going to Iraq, it is not without challenges, Kaveh. I myself went to the border, and unfortunately, I was not able to cross into Iraq. And like me, there are many people who are heartbroken because they were not able to make it to this annual pilgrimage. And that is why on the day of Arba'in today, which is the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, across Iran, in all the cities, all over the country, those people who wanted to take part in the Arba'in walk and were not able to make it, take part in these symbolic walks in their cities. In Tehran, one of the hugest crowds across the country has gathered more than a million, I assume more than a million people are taking part in only the capital, Tehran, walking from Imam Hussein Square, downtown Tehran, to Shush Square, and then leading to where I'm standing, which is the Shah Abdul Azim Holy Shrine, again in the Iranian capital, Tehran. And there are many people who are here who are taking part in this symbolic walk, which just goes to show that the spirit of Arba'in and Imam Hussein and the values that he fought for transcend all borders. People who are here taking part, offering water, that's again another symbolic gesture. So many people holding the trays of water, because as you know, in the Battle of Karbala, one of the cruelest things that happened was that the army of Yazid prevented the Imam Hussein and his companions to have access to water. So this is again another symbolic gesture, remembering Imam Hussein, remembering the sacrifices he made, what he fought for. And let's not forget, Kaveh, that this is all about the values that Imam Hussein stood up for. So the people who are taking part in the Arba'in walk, they're also going over not just the historical events, but the spirit behind it. And their love for Imam Hussein and their love for that ideology and the reason why they're taking part in this walk is to show that they want to walk down the same path that Imam Hussein did, which is very interesting because you see so many younger people taking part in the Arba'in walk. I'm even joined by one of them who will explain more, because it's very nice to see how this even transcends generations who are here to take part in this spiritual journey and the symbolic Arba'in walk. So please tell us, how old are you, and do you take part in this walk every year, or did this happen only this year, and why did you take part?
Since I was a kid, we hold up this ceremony every year to shout out Imam Hussein and Hazrat Zainab and their respectful families.
Okay, so this year I also saw a lot of people your age holding the flag of Gaza. There's even one right now behind us over there. What does this year's Arba'in walk have to do with the people of Gaza?
You know, this year feels very different with other year. I feel more passion in people. I feel their hate to Zionism regime. And we want to stand next to our Palestinian brothers and sisters against this Zionism regime.
Well, Kaveh, there you have it, a younger member of the younger generation here, Iran's Gen Z, actually, taking part in the Arbaeen Walk and explaining why and what inspired her to take part. These are very moving moments, very inspiring. When I talk to people who are taking part in this particular march in Tehran, for those who were left behind, which, like I said, shows that the spirit of Arbaeen transcends all borders.
Thank you very much for that. Gisu Mishamhedi there, live for us from Tehran. Thank you, Gisu.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Listeners special. In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special on this Sunday, August 25th, 2024. I'm Atefe Irfani, hosting this program today, and condolences to you all on the occasion of Arbaeen, which is 40 days after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, the second grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny in Karbala, Iraq, in 61 AH. Please stay with us. Millions of pilgrims make their way to Karbala each year to participate in the Arbaeen gathering. The Arbaeen pilgrimage, which commemorates the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, is recognized as the world's largest annual public gathering. Each year, on the 20th of Safar, millions of Shia Muslims walk to Karbala from various starting points, including Najaf, to honor the sacrifices made during the Battle of Karbala in 680 CE. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, we've received reception reports and emails from around the world. This time, Akiyoshi Traoka from Japan, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us a piece of email. And here we've received an email from Malik Alobochaya from Pakistan. And here we have reception reports from Akiyoshi Traoka from Japan and Anand Mohan from India. Stay with us, please. I will be back with you. Thank you. Welcome back. Akiyoshi Traoka, one of our old and regular listeners from Japan, has sent us a piece of email. And before the program, I was reading this email. Actually, Akiyoshi Traoka has written about the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza. He says, "Hi, I'm Akiyoshi Traoka. Discuss war in general. If violence were the only way to express one's will, it might have been inevitable to get involved. But didn't we have any other choice? A new international principle is needed to prevent wars from getting out of hand and escalating into major wars. If this is not done, justice will be destroyed by war. To keep us out of war, we need a change in the basic principles of international ethics. Why don't small and medium-sized nations get together to discuss and decide on the stance to be taken? Then the big powers will renounce war itself. We must also remember that the root of the problem lies in British triple-tongue diplomacy. The British diplomat Balfour once declared that he would support the establishment of a Jewish state in the land of Palestine if the Jews sided with the Allies. Such home-first colonialism and other forms of existence that deprive the Palestinian people of social justice and drive them to despair are extremely evil. The Palestinian people are treated as people who do not deserve anything. Let us look around. The permanent members of the Security Council are colonialists themselves. Britain and France have overseas territories, and the U.S. violates other countries' commercial interests. I hope that peace will come soon, Akiyoshi Traoka." First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, Akiyoshi Traoka from Japan. Thank you very much for writing about the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza and the countries that support this genocide, including the U.S. regime, Britain, France, and some other Western countries. Many thanks for writing about this issue, which is the most upgraded issue in the world right now. Write to us soon and tell us your views about the world developments, especially the genocide by the Zionist regime in Gaza, and of course about IRIB English radio programs. And EQSL will be sent to you as confirmation to this email. Please accept our appreciations to you for writing this email. After a short break, I will be back with you. Dear listeners, the Arba'in Walk is a significant annual pilgrimage in Shia Islam commemorating the 40 days following the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The pilgrimage serves as a spiritual journey and symbolizes the enduring struggle against oppression and injustice. Pilgrims receive hospitality along the way with volunteers providing food, drinks, and medical assistance. The U.S.-backed Zionist genocidal war in Gaza has prompted this year's Arba'in, the largest annual pilgrimage in the world, to raise awareness about the issue of Palestine and the issue of Gaza. The 80-kilometer route from the holy southern Iraqi cities of Najaf to Karbala, in which pilgrims walk on foot, is flooded with Palestinian symbols in a strong protest to the Zionist regime's genocide and the Zionist regime's war crimes and the crimes against humanity in the besieged Gaza Strip. In 2023, last year, more than 20 million people took part in the Arba'in ritual. At the start of the journey, the call to Al-Aqsa Center has been set up to represent the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Israeli-occupied city of Al-Quds. So far, these have included speeches by prominent figures, wounded members of the Iraqi resistance honoring an injured Palestinian from Gaza, as well as a visit by the governor of Karbala wearing the Palestinian keffiyeh. The governor of Karbala has not been alone in putting on the keffiyeh. Pilgrims from around the world, Iranians, Syrians, Lebanese, many people, Iraqi people themselves, many Muslims from around the world, the Azerbaijanis, the Nigerians have been photographed with the Palestinian keffiyeh around their necks and waving the Palestinian flag in their hands. The Palestinian flag has also been a common symbol on the road from Najaf to Karbala. Pilgrims are waving the flag while hundreds of thousands of places offering food and other services along the route have raised the flag of Palestine alongside the banner of the community they represent. Yes. This is the message of the Arba'in Walk this year, 2024, along the road from Najaf to Karbala. And that is actually showing our solidarity with Palestine and supporting the people of Gaza, and also showing our hatred toward the Zionist regime, that is oppression. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special. And as I said, Malik Hala Bochai from Pakistan, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us a piece of email. Malik Hala Bochai says, "Hello, I'm from Pakistan and a shortwave radio listener. Kindly post me literature about your radio. I'm waiting for your response. Regards." First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Malik Hala Bochai from Pakistan. Thank you very much for sending this piece of email to IRIB English Radio and Listeners Special program. Please accept our EQSL as confirmation to this email. Write to us soon and tell us your views about our programs. Welcome back, dear listeners. And what is interesting in this year's actually Arba'in Walk is that hundreds of Palestinians are helping to organize events this year in a strong sign of Shia and Sunni unity. At the time when critics have censured the U.S. and the Zionist regime of setting up an online cyber army to drive a wedge between two major sects of Islam. The pro-Palestine mobilization has caught the imagination of social media users online, where all freedom-seeking people are posting and reposting the pictures coming out of the Arba'in Walk. The Arba'in Walk, which marks 40 days since Ashura, represents many lessons taken from the sacrifices of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in the Battle of Karbala, despite the battle occurring some 1,400 years ago. One of these lessons is that Imam Hussein, peace upon him, with his 72 companions, did not surrender to a tyrannical ruler who dispatched tens of thousands of troops to kill the Imam without showing any mercy or humanity. Also, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was under siege for several days and prevented from collecting water for his thirsty family and children and for the thirsty children of his companions. And today, the Palestinians in Gaza are also under total siege by the Tel Aviv regime. Palestinian children are also thirsty, yet Gaza refuses to wave the white flag to surrender. In the Battle of Karbala, Imam Hussein chose to die in dignity rather than surrender in humiliation to a tyrant. The Palestinians are also refusing to surrender to a criminal regime called the Zionist regime, the fabricated regime of Israel. Many lovers of a free and just world participating in the Arba'in this year have the Palestinians' struggle for freedom in their thoughts. The horrific yet resilient scenes coming out of Gaza have inspired them to raise the flag of Palestine in the largest annual gathering in the world. The scenes coming out from Gaza is what inspires them to raise the flag of Palestine in the largest annual gathering on the planet. The Arba'in ceremony is unique in that it is the largest gathering with the presence of people from different nationalities from across the world. This has become a transnational and global event. It ignites the sparks of Ashura, turning it into a movement. This global gathering offers a significant opportunity to amplify the voice of the oppressed Palestinian people on an international level. And on that note, here we come to the end of our today's listeners special. Many thanks for being with us. But before saying goodbye, I just wanted to thank those of you who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails from around the world, including Malik Alabachaya from Pakistan, Akiyoshi Troaka from Japan, Anand Mohan from India. Yes, and please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and listeners, a special program. We wish you all the best. God bless you and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. All 19 individuals of Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian's proposed cabinet was approved by the Majlis, or Parliament, on Wednesday. Though the majority of Parliament members are principalists and the government is more reformist, all of the proposed ministers received enough votes to be part of the 14th government. Now, the President has stressed the importance of national reconciliation, and there is optimism that everyone will try to work together to improve the country, this at a very challenging time in the region and in the world. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program as we take a look at the 14th government of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Well, we have Maryam Azad Chair of the Iran desk here in Tehran and Sayed Muaz Shah, Executive Director, Center for Islamic Law and Human Rights out of Karachi. Well, I'm going to start this off with Maryam. Maryam, your perspective, how significant is it that all 19 proposed cabinet members of the president were approved by the Majlis, our parliament?
Well, thank you, Marzi. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is but the second time that this has happened in some 46 years. So it's very significant. I mean, for all of the ministers to receive the vote of confidence, and you have to, I mean, pay attention to the fact that we have our president, President Pezeshkian, he is from the Reformist Party, and the representatives, the parliament is predominantly actually principalist, and they have approved all of these candidates. Now, 15 out of the 19 candidates for the ministries actually received more than 200 votes. That is, you see, the minimum for becoming a minister is 145 votes. But they have received 200 votes, like 15 have received 200 and over votes. So this is actually very significant this way.
Okay, well, Sayed Muaz, you know, Iran has seen a lot of ups and downs, especially looking at the last 3 months. If we see, like, on May the 19th, of course, when the nation was shocked into finding out that President Raisi was martyred in a helicopter crash. And, of course, besides the funerals for those who had been killed, the country had 50 days to hold elections and then had to hold two elections. And, of course, then the inauguration of Dr. Pezeshkian. I mean, your overall assessment of how the country has handled the sudden transition overall until the cabinet was approved.
You know, thank you for having me. I think this is a really reflective moment of Iran's solidarity and spirit of resistance, spirit of unity in times of difficulty. And that's the spirit of the Iranian revolution that we're seeing unfold before us. The Iranian people coming together in difficult time, as you mentioned, the loss of their leader a few months back, and of course the recent attacks in Tehran and what's going on in Gaza, all that interconnected, and facing this challenge of the United States and European Union's support for Israel. You know, and of course, we know some of the EU countries have been breaking ranks and things are slowly eroding, but this shows the resilience of the Iranian people coming together in a tough time. And you know, it's not about those petty politics that we're seeing, for example, in Israel unfolding right now. We see a country on the other side here coming together, people from all parts of the spectrum, as my colleague mentioned, there's a reformist party. And getting this type of consensus of more than 200 parliamentarians is something unheard of. Hasn't happened since 2001. I think that was the last time something has happened like that. All the ministers have been approved. And this clearly shows the direction where this country, it is ready to take on challenges. And there will be some coming through the door, as we know what's going on with Gaza and what's going on in southern Lebanon. And also within Iran itself. Particularly coming from the West, and perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes, exactly. We definitely will. Well, let's get into some of the challenges, Maryam, when we talk about the various challenges that this government may have. Let's start from inside the country, because let's talk about what President Pezeshkian has reiterated, what is important to him, and the main goals of this government.
Well, as you know, I mean, the challenges stated by presidential candidates in general when they were running for presidency, by Dr. Pezeshkian, by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, is how important economy is. Because, I mean, Iran is a very strong country in many ways. You know, its role in the axis of resistance, you know that, I mean, despite all the threats that has been on Iran ever since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has grown to be a major power, not only in the region, but in the world. However, there are certain issues. Now, as you know, there are so many different things that are going on in terms of basically teachings, in terms of family, in terms of housing, all of these issues that is happening to the basically ordinary people. And a lot of governments are not very much focused on that. And they put it on, I mean, they allow for so much of a free market that there are rarely any government programs a lot of times, or they're very insufficient that in terms of helping people with housing. Now, in Iran, for instance, it used to be that there was a very good focus on basically Iranians being homeowners, right? And now, as there are more economic difficulties, there has been a shift away from that, and we are having fewer people being homeowners. So these are actually some of the major challenges inside the country, is that the economy. Now, it has to do with the job market. It has to do with housing. It has to do with a lot of different issues that we're facing, partially because of the sanctions. Of course, two-thirds of the world is sanctioned by the U.S. However, I don't think any country has been sanctioned to the same extent that Iran has been sanctioned. And Iran has been dealing with this for 46 years. But as the president said, actually, he said that, you know what, I mean, with all these, of course, sanctions are a huge burden. But the president himself said that we cannot blame the U.S. for everything, because really, Iran is a rich country. Iran has a very rich culture. Iran has a very rich history. Iran could have done much better even with the sanctions. And as the president said in one of his speeches, that we very much have ourselves to blame, and that basically what he believes, and what a lot of Iranians believe actually, is that we cannot have a system where we have, I mean, not like the U.S. where, like, there's always, you know, there are the main two parties that every party is trying to basically downgrade the other party, and they're not cooperating. And, of course, they have the deep state, and that's a whole other story. But what the president has been talking about is that we can actually solve the issues inside the country, regardless of what the U.S. might do, if we only have unity, if we have a national consensus. And he's very right in that. I think a lot of Iranians heard that, and they felt that, and they said that this is what we have to do. And I think that, I mean, this powerful speech was also part of the reason that, because as I told you, we already had that, we had the predominantly principalist parliament voting in every single minister suggested by a reformist president. Of course, he's everyone's president now, but let's remember he is from the reformist party. So they have put these differences aside. Okay. They're saying, let's work together.
Yeah, very significant. What about that said, Moaz, what Mary Mazzocheh has said? I mean, when we look at, because we've always heard, especially if you look at very entities outside of the country in talking about the divide. But what the president has continued to stress since he's taken office, and even prior to that, was the importance of unity, working together. And what we saw today seems to indicate that the parliament, the Majlis, is also on board with that. The question for you, Said Moaz, how significant and important is that right now when we look at the situation that is taking place in the region and globally? You mentioned earlier about, of course, Palestine and the genocide, and, of course, the pressures from the various supporters of the Zionist entity. I mean, your take on that side of things.
Well, I think that's a very important point, because in his speech he made it very clear where the foreign policy was going to be focused. And he basically went down and said, basically, Far East Asia, China, Africa, Latin America, pretty much the whole world aside from Europe and the United States and Northern America. And I think that was a very kind of interesting kind of pivot that was very important, because he was bold about, this is where our priority regions. These are the regions where we will be kind of building relationships with again goes into that global shift that's been going on for quite a bit, that where we have this China, Russia challenges this U.S. hegemonic 50 years of, what you can say, even post-Cold War scenario, rather, where it's just been one-sided. And I think that dynamic is definitely going to be in that direction. So foreign policy-wise, I don't see any major changes. I must give a caveat for this, because one of the selections of the ministers that was somewhat criticized was Abbas Araghchi, and he was one of the negotiators for the Iranian deal. And there were some questions around that. But I still feel that, you know, if you remember, Donald Trump was the one in 2020 that unilaterally pulled out of that. So I think this also sends a message internationally, because we know the U.S. is kind of even at times abandoning Israel. And we know a lot of European states have broken ranks. And so this is actually kind of an interesting play here, that Iran is basically saying, look, those who want to talk on principle, we're opening the doors for you on that. You know, one of the major things I must also make a mention here of another minister that is very important is Farzana Sadiq. And the reason why is, you know, recently there was a lot of criticism about Iran and the treatment of women. It's in this mantra of the West, and we already know that's the kind of propaganda that they put out to try to build some anti-Iranian sentiment in their circles. That was actually quite important as well, because it's showing again that these rumors and this idea that women are secondary citizens in the Islamic Republic of Iran is far from the truth. So I think that was also a very important move. I think Iran is positioning itself very strategically on the international fronts when it comes to diplomatic means. And I think some of the people that are brought forth create that atmosphere where those who want to break rank from this ridiculous behavior that Israel has turned to, bombing schools, hospitals, just horrendous things. There's nothing they can stand for. So if Iran is showing a window of opportunity to engage, I think this is going to bind the United States and Israel. And I think this is the real win. And we have to wait to see how this will play out. But I think this is as important as the military front, of course, and that, of course, the revolutionary support. He reiterated these elements of the resistance. But I think also, you know, there's some things that can be won from the pen. And I think we're going to start to see some of that in this new cabinet that he's put together.
Okay. Well, Maryam, Sayed Muaz talked about the mantra coming out of the West. And I mean, looking at the whole run-up to this election, and that if we look at foreign media and how they talked about it, that either it doesn't make a difference who will be elected, because actually more of a selection, it's the leader who decides everything. I mean, your thoughts, and even up until today, of how that coverage has been.
Now, Marzia, you know better than I do. I mean, there's, of course, we have to cover it for the audiences. And I think the audience already knows. I mean, first of all, look at who is talking about this. I mean, I was just reading BBC articles accusing Iran of, you know, just focusing on basically just it's all about the ideology. It's not about basically expertise. And I'm like, you guys have a king, for goodness sake. It's the 21st century. I mean, he gets to pick the prime minister. A lot of your taxes go to paying him, the royal family, the House of Lords. So it's all, I mean, you know, so one aspect of it is to, first of all, take a look at who is doing this. I mean, only 3 days ago was the anniversary of the coup d'etat in Iran. Now, this is prior to the Islamic Revolution. Now, when Iran had a prime minister that was trying to nationalize Iran's oil, what did the Brits and the U.S. did? What they did was they started a coup and they overthrew Iran's democratically elected prime minister. So it's really not about democracy. I mean, if they had access now to Iran's oil, if they had managed to basically keep plundering Iran's oil, you would not be hearing anything about them from them regarding Iran's democracy. I mean, now you see how they're treating Libya, right? So after Gaddafi, and of course it was all about democracy. It was all about treating women, how they treat women, and so. So first of all, let's take a look at who's saying that. It's very important. And I feel like generally, it's not only about what is said, but who is saying that. That's very important for our audiences, I think. And I think they have very much understood. understood, especially with the genocide, with the ongoing genocide. They see the people, the entities, they see the regimes always, that are always talking about democracy, are now supporting a genocide that people are seeing, like, basically every day on a daily basis, and they're like, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? Why isn't the international institutions doing anything about this? Because they were not made to do anything about
right.
this. Because so, right. I mean, we have this on one hand, and when you come back, I actually want to get a little more into detail with actually how Iran's systems work.
Right. Well, Saidmoaz, you heard what Mariam said about watching who says what and who's doing what. When we look at the time of what is happening right now in the world, and as she said, especially during this ongoing genocide, more and more people are becoming aware of the reality. On the other side of the coin, do you think more and more people are becoming aware of Iran, Iran's world, Iran's role as far as being the leader of the resistance front and the importance of it? I mean, do you see this assessment being changed globally as more reality is setting in for people or not?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is not just true for the Islamic world. This is true for even beyond the Islamic world and non-Muslim jurisdictions who clearly see Iran as a true champion of peace and human rights and the Palestinian people. And I'm not saying that just to be saying that. The reality is what Israel has done is not only childish behavior, it's completely behavior that violates every norm, international law, basic ethics. And Iran is the only state, officially speaking, aside from, of course, groups, and I should say even in Yemen to some extent, who have been standing with the Palestinian people and doing something about it. And this is, I think, very important because it symbolizes that this is the actors. These countries are the actors actually doing something for the Palestinians. And there is no doubt in my mind that if we pick up anybody, 9 out of 10 people across the world are supporting the Palestinian people, are sympathetic to the Palestinian people, and they see Iran in this positive light. And all those little critiques that I mentioned about earlier, like, for example, what my colleague also mentioned here, is the how the anti-women perspective, they're addressing these things through possibly the minister. You have people who are saying, oh, they don't want to negotiate. Then they're bringing in these reformists that have, in a sense, they're more welcoming, you can say, because people say, oh, the others were a little bit more hardline. This is creating a more diplomatic environment, and I think this cannot be a better moment right now for Iran to make this move and have these people in these positions. Because even those people who are on the sidelines with Iran and they had sympathy with the Palestinians now are like, listen, these guys, this current cabinet is someone that we can really approach. And I feel that Iran is, like I said earlier, you know, it's one thing to get things done militarily. It's another to get things done diplomatically. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that happening with this new cabinet, a diplomatic front to end what's going on in Israel and beyond that, the injustices that, of course, the hegemonic front, as you always say, carries on. And I think Iran has identified before the world's eyes, before the people of the world, that they are the nation that stands up against this aggression.
Okay. Well, Mariam, I mean, your thoughts when we look at the situation we're talking about in the world and also looking at what the hegemonic front has been saying about Iran, even with this election and now that Mr. Pezeshkian has taken over, trying to say that there is a difference, Iran is going to be somewhat different in how they deal, for example, with the Palestinian situation or in general. I mean, your assessment of that.
Well, this is a very old technique that they've always been doing that. They have always labeled certain people with a different culture as the other, right? So we have the reformists, we have the principalists, and they generally call the principalists hardliners or ultra-conservatives or, you know, just crazies, basically. So this is how they have always portrayed. I mean, and we have these different parties. Of course, here's something to have in mind. Iran has a very different culture. Iran is a Muslim-majority country. Iran is a Shia-majority country. You know, even in Iran, even, I mean, people come and they're amazed by, I mean, the the variety of people and their opinions, but
30 seconds. You have 30 seconds, okay. Mary. I'm sorry.
So in all their different walks of life, Iranians are anti-imperialism, right? So, but what the imperialists have been trying to do, they've been trying to say that, in the beginning, they say, the reformist candidate is not going to win presidency. Then he does. Because, as you know, most of our governments have been reformist governments. Then they say they're not going to let him pick his ministers. Then he does. Then they say the principalists are not going to vote in the ministers. And then he does. And then they're like, they were all picked by the leader anyways. Well, you know what? Our leader is running the axis of resistance, and the American president cannot run up two stairs. So obviously people have respect for our leader, as others don't have for theirs. So.
Okay, well said, Moaz. Looking at, of course, this very sensitive time, and of course Iran has said that it's going to respond to the Ismail Haniyeh assassination that took place inside of this country. Do you see that as a challenge? Do you think that this government would handle it different? Or do you see this as a continuation, the same line, even if President Raisi was in power, or now that Mr. Pezeshkian is in power, that line of actually resistance and standing up against hegemonic powers is still the criteria?
There be no doubt. That is the same stance and principle that will remain, because the Islamic Republic of Iran is here to stay. And I think that's the point that people need to realize. And what my colleague was mentioning is exactly those things, is they don't realize that in principle, Iran, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, is here to stay. Now, if you want to come to the table and negotiate and talk and give principled ethics in that discussion, more than welcome. And you know what? There might be a different strategy. As I said, maybe not so much as a military one, as a diplomatic one, but not to say that they're going to not exercise the military options. Of course they will, but they will also use diplomatic weapons in a way that I think that's different. So this is one thing that's different, but in principle, they're not going to change that stance. And let that be very clear for people who think otherwise.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mary Mazacheb, Iran Desk. Zed Moaz Shah, Executive Director, Center for Islamic Law and Human Rights, out of Karachi. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان
لا إله إلا
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Call of Islam page, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is over here in our studio to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about the effects and the results, and it's better to call it the fruits of the uprising of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with its, we can say, succeeding uprisings like Qiyam al-Mukhtar and Qiyam al-Tawwabin. In fact, what were the fruits? Historically speaking, when we take a look at the tragedies that took place on that time, yes, the enemy was victorious. The Umayyads were victorious against Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. But the really ripe fruits of the uprising and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam took place years after that. What are those fruits? Let's talk a little bit about them, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That unfortunately, after the shahada of Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, and even before that, we see that the Amawids and later Marwanids and Abbasids, unfortunately, at their times, the series, the different kind of Islamic societies, communities, they completely culturally changed into non-Islamic kind of culture. We see that the predominant kind of features of the culture of the people were mostly non-Islamic. If you, for example, refer to some of the sources like Al-Aghani, like Tariq Mas'udi, or the other sources, we see that even sometimes the Islamic cities became the cities of haram things that we can even not mention the names.
Yes.
They became like the cities of like dancing, singing, musics, yes. I don't know, ribas or... And this sort of things.
The bars and the...
Yeah,
and the crops, that's
this
right.
This is mentioned in the history. So if Qiyam of Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam were not there, this kind of culture, this kind of Islam became predominant Islam all over the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing from the pure teachings of the Islam, nothing from the pure culture of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, the conduct of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam would remain in the history.
All right.
So Qiyam of Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam caused lots of things in the history. First of all, it makes the people aware of another reading of Islam, which were completely blocked and neglected by the Amawids and Marwanids. You know?
Yeah, right.
Because the